This is Age of Treason Radio.
First thing I remember was asking Papa why. For there were many things I didn't know.
On the White Network.
By the hand, saying someday you'll understand. Well, I'm here to tell you now that you never mother's gone. You better learn your past, you better learn young, for someday it never come.
With your host, Tan Stoffel. The title of this installment is Jewish Crypsis, Religion, Part 2. I reviewed the last time some of the key aspects of Jewish religion, these texts that Jewish religion is based on, Torah, Tanakh, Talmud, and finally, toward the end, Zohar. And I'd like to speak some more about Zohar and a few other aspects of more recent developments in Judaism as well. And I want to drive home the point that I finished with in my conclusion the last time, that Jewishness is best understood not as a religion, but as a people. And I think that will come through in what I have to say this time. So, as I was saying the last time, the Zohar first appeared in Spain in the 13th century. And the interesting thing about that period of time is this was in Spain under Muslim occupation. This is what the Jews consider their golden age. If you Google Jewish golden age, it talks about the caliphate in Spain, and Jewish life blossomed. They thrived under the Muslims in Spain. So, that's just one interesting thing that I didn't find mentioned in the Wikipedia article about Zohar. I actually skipped something I thought was important I had marked here, but I didn't mention it, that the Moses de Leon, who some speculate wrote it and who claimed to have discovered it in the 13th century, he ascribed the work to Shimon bar Yochai, a rabbi of the second century during the Roman persecution. There's the persecution again. Every one of these Jewish texts is described by the Wikipedia articles, which I assume are vetted by Jews, if not written by Jews themselves, as persecution. That is at the center of the Jewish narrative about what it means to be a Jew is to be persecuted. Persecution! Adding Scott would say. There are people of religions, and this is the interesting thing about Zohar and the Kabbalah that arises out of it. There are people of religions beside Judaism, or even those without religious affiliation, who delve into the Zohar out of curiosity, or as a technology for people who are seeking meaningful and practical answers about the meaning of their lives, the purpose of creation, existence, and their relationships with the laws of nature and so forth. However, from the perspective of traditional rabbinic Judaism and by the Zohar's own statements, the purpose of the Zohar is to help the Jewish people through and out of the exile and to infuse the Torah and mitzvot, the Judaic commandments, with the wisdom of Kabbalah for its Jewish readers. In other words, it's for Jews, the Jewish people. The belief, as I've mentioned, that the authenticity of the Zohar is questionable, that who wrote it exactly, was it actually written in the second century or later, is what separates Orthodox or Haredi Jews from the others. The conservative and Reform Jews tend to take it metaphorically. They believe it was written more recently, but that it was based on observations of the Torah, and so in that sense it was legitimate. But I thought that was an interesting aspect of what divides these different sects of Jews, their different beliefs. The article on Kabbalah is the next thing I'm going to move to here. And Kabbalah is not only based on Zohar. Zohar is just it's one of its fundamental texts. Kabbalah is essentially Jewish mysticism. It's what they call Jewish mysticism today. There's always been a strain of mysticism in Judaism or amongst Jews, I should say. There's an aspect that I don't find mentioned in the Wikipedia article of Kabbalah as numerology. There's a strong aspect of that. And what is numerology? It's this belief in a spiritual or mystical significance to numbers, as opposed to mathematics, which is like a study of the logic of numbers and cold, hard facts about numbers. Numerology is just kind of pulled out of thin air, these mystical beliefs about significance of numbers and translating text character by character into numbers and then attaching some significance to those numbers, or vice versa, taking numbers and attaching significance to text. To put it in terms that white nationalists or pro-white people would understand, the 14 words is an example of that in our own belief system. What's interesting about Kabbalah is how it cuts across the various subsets of Jews and Jewish beliefs and the influence outside of Jews that it has, as I cited in that paragraph I just read about the Zohar. According to the Zohar, a foundational text for Kabbalistic thought, Torah study can proceed along four levels of interpretation. And the four levels are simple, or direct interpretations, hints, or allegorical meaning, inquire or seek. These are words I'm taking from the article itself on what Kabbalah is. And the fourth, by the way, inquire and seek, the third technique is midrashic or rabbinic meaning. So if you remember, midrash is the first part of the Torah, Talmud. And then the fourth, which really gets at what Kabbalah is the secret or mystery, searching for the inner or esoteric or metaphysical meaning of the Torah. And that is Kabbalah. That is what Kabbalah is. Now, there's a funny thing. There's a section in this article about Kabbalah titled Distinction Between Jews and Non-Jews. And I think this is interesting because you could have found a section like this in any of the other articles about the other texts of Judaism, Torah and Talmud. And there was a little bit of it in Talmud. They focused mainly on the attacks and how they were I discussed how they were launched by converts, by basically traitorous Jews who had left the Jewish community and had betrayed the Jews, this Jewish secrets, to the non-Jews. But they didn't get so much into what those details are. They sort of brush them off. You know, I guess like the Jews say at the ADL, they're canard, as if they don't really exist. But they actually get into some detail here about Kabbalistic distinction between Jews and non-Jews. It says, a number of medieval Kabbalistic sources contain statements to the effect that the Jewish soul is ontologically different from the soul of non-Jews. That means from the very beginning or from the roots of its existence, the very nature of its existence, ontologically different. For example, it is held by some that Jews have three levels of soul, nefesh, ruach, and neshama, while non-Jews only have nefesh, the lowest form. Such theologically framed hostility may have been a response to some medieval demonization of Jews, which developed in some parts of Western or Christian society and thought. That's pure BS. It's a perfect example of how Jews, even when they're doing something wrong, even when they're doing something hostile to the people around them, try to spin it as, well, but it's really their fault. We're just responding to hostility from other people. I don't believe it for a moment. I think that the truth is actually much more close to this. Hostility springs originally and almost entirely from the Jews, although speaking objectively, I think it's a mutual thing. But I think the Jews are full of it. David Halperin argues that the collapse of Kabbalah's influence amongst Western European Jews over the course of the 17th and 18th centuries was a result of the cognitive dissonance they experienced between the negative perception of Gentiles found in some exponents of Kabbalah and their own positive dealings with non-Jews, which were rapidly expanding and improving during this period of due to the influence of the Enlightenment. This was the Jewish emancipation and the increased opportunities that they had afforded to them in European society, being treated as equals, equal citizens, and eligible for any position within society. However, a number of renowned Kabbalists claim the exact opposite. Well, of course they did. These are Jews we're talking about. They never agree about anything. In their view, Kabbalah transcends the borders of Judaism and can serve as a basis of interreligious theosophy and a universal religion. What we see here is another example of duality, Jewish duality, that on the one hand, some Jews argue how Kabbalah is by Jews, it's about Jews, it's for Jews, and Jews alone. And then we have on the other Jews who argue it's for everyone. Two totally different arguments. But, you know, in the minds of both groups of Jews, they're really just doing what they think is best for Jews. You know, in I think the first explanation is actually closer to the truth, that it's by Jews, about Jews, and for Jews alone. And that these other expressions, that they feel somewhat embarrassed by the fact that other people that aren't Jews are even interested in Kabbalah. You know, they tried to make it secret and mysterious and off-putting, hoping to chase people away. But when that failed, they pretended, hey, it's for everybody. Yeah, it's wonderful. The word Kabbal is related to Kabbalah. Kabbal spelt with a C as opposed to Kabbalah, which is spelt ordinarily with a K. They arose about the same time. I found an article, not in Wikipedia, but from the Jewish Chronicle, written by a rabbi that claims that Kabbal entered the Jewish language in the late 16th century, and it means a secret intrigue, a plot, or a conspiracy. What a coincidence. The coinage coincided with the rising awareness of Jewish mystical teachings, the Kabbalah, in non-Jewish circles. See, Jewish Kabbalah had been ongoing for quite a while by that time, and it was only as it became known to others that the word Kabbal came into existence. Interesting. Now, another topic I'd like to discuss and sort of transition into here is the Hasidim. And this is the name for the people, the subset of Jewish people. It turns out one of the things that differentiates them from other types of Jews is their heavy belief in Kabbalah, where Kabbalah is a strain of Jewish thought in other groups of Jews. In the Hasidim, it's a dominant strain. It's a characteristic of the Hasidim. The Hasidim themselves are a type of Orthodox Jew. In fact, their rapid rise, and this is an interesting aspect of the history, their rapid rise really constituted a schism with other Orthodox Ashkenazi Jews in the same part of Eastern Europe, where the Hasidim first began this rapid rise. And the other non-Hasidic Ashkenazi were called the Mishnagdim. I've never heard that word before, but there's an article about it in Wikipedia that I'll link to. You can read about it. I'm going to just try and summarize what I've learned there. But the Mishnagim, what they didn't like about the Harad, sorry, it's hard to keep these things separate. The Hasidim, what they didn't like about the Hasidim and the Hasidic Jews was their exuberance, this sort of extremist, garish. And these are my words now. They use the word exuberant, but I would describe it as extremist, garish, clownish behavior and dress that the Hasidim engaged in, and this messianic fervor that they had for their religion, for their belief. They wore it on their sleeves, as I've said before, about Orthodox Jews in general. It's really the Hasidim who did this. And their messianic fervor and their belief in which is really just a belief in these charismatic leaders and verging into thinking of them as prophets or even verging into thinking them as saviors and godlike figures. You know, Jesus is an example of that. Jews consider him a failed prophet or a false prophet, but there have been many since Jesus, that the Jews have fallen in behind. And the Hasidim seem to really capture that strand of Jewish nature. Let me quote a few sections here from the Hasidic Judaism page from Wikipedia. The schism between the Hasids and Hasidim and the other Orthodox Jews was eventually healed. And the reconciliation took place in response to the perceived even greater threat of the Haskalah, or Jewish Enlightenment. This corresponded with what we Europeans call the Enlightenment, which is when Jewish emancipation took place. And we see that from a pro-white, pro-European point of view, in retrospect, as a great tragedy for Europeans. It was a big mistake that Europeans made, that was imposed on us, really, from the top down, when the elite decided that they were going to make the Jews equal citizens and open up their doors, the doors of society and politics and furthermore to Jews and open up the society. The Jews see it in a different way. They saw it as a threat because they valued their separateness and they thought this would be, you know, the Europeans opening their arms and welcoming the Jews was a threat. It was assimilation is a threat to their peoplehood. They won't exist as a people anymore if they convert and put on the clothing of everybody else and look like everybody else and act like everybody else and start thinking of themselves like everybody else. In the mid-19th century, the influence of modern changes in Jewish society arrived east from the Western European secularizing Haskalah. That's what they call the Jewish Enlightenment. While the unsuccessful 1812 French invasion of Russia by Napoleon had sought to bring Jewish emancipation to the non-Jewish political structures of Poland and Russia, Haskalah sought to reform and rationalize Jewish thought and life from within the Jewish community to form an image of Jewish observance in the character of non-Jewish modernity. You know, they always have this really kind of slimy, slippery way of describing things. What they were trying to do was adapt Jewishness to the changing environment. You know, the Europeans were losing their religion, and that's what the Enlightenment was about, the realization that, hey, we don't need this religion. Science is much more powerful. Rational thought is, you know, the age of reason. That all of that explains much more about how the world really works. It has tangible results. We're going to go that way instead of religion. And you know, Christianity really started to lose its grip. And Judaism was faced with this problem that simultaneously the Europeans tried to welcome the Jews as equal citizens, but at the same time an awareness of the Jews as a separate people racially, biologically, started to dawn on Europeans. And the Jews, their Haskalah was a sort of response to that, but it created a schism for Jews. And that's really where the reform and the conservative and reform flavors of Jews originates from, is from that Haskalah. adaptation to Jewish emancipation. They wanted to remain Jews, but you know, it's a lot like the nose job thing and the name change thing. They may change certain aspects of themselves, but it's not because they want to stop being Jews. It's because they want to stop being recognized as Jews. And that's the same here for this Haskalah business. One of the aspects of the of these Hasidim that separates them from other Jews is that they consider the use of Hebrew for anything other than prayer and study profane. And hence Yiddish is the vernacular and common tongue for many Hasidim around the world, and in addition to whatever language they speak of the people around them. So, for instance, in the United States, they speak English for everyday interaction with the people around them, to the extent that they keep that minimal, but they have to interact to some extent. And then they also speak Yiddish for their ordinary day-to-day life amongst themselves. And then they speak Hebrew as well. This facility for language is a hallmark of Jews. Another community or subset of Jews I'd like to talk about are the Haradrim, or Haredim, sorry, of which the Hasidim are a subset or a part. The Haredi Judaism article I found informative on this. The Haredim view themselves as the most authentic group of Jews. The word denotes staunchly Orthodox Jews and is increasingly used in the diaspora in place of quote-unquote ultra-Orthodox, which some view as inaccurate or offensive, it being seen as a derogatory term suggesting extremism. As I said, what the Jews described the resistance to the Hasidim as being based on their exuberance, I translated into their extremist, garish, clownish appearance and behavior and thinking. And Jews, being sensitive to that, have you know, sort of changed the name. They've come up with a different word, substituted a different word to sort of cover that up. Many Haredim view manner of dress as an important way to ensure Jewish identity and distinctiveness. To Zionists, Haredi Jews, this is in Israel now, to Zionists, Haredi Jews were either quote-unquote primitives or parasites. To Haredi Jews, the Zionists were tyrannizing heretics. Despite the animosity, it was necessary for the two groups to work out some modus vivendi, an agreement for getting along, in the face of a more dangerous enemy, the Nazis. This was achieved by a division of powers and authority. And they're talking about in the British mandate now, what's used to be called Palestine, before there was an Israel during the war. Based on the division that existed during the British mandate in the country, known as, quote-unquote, the status quo. It granted political authority, such as control over public institutions, the army, etc., to the Zionists, and religious authority, such as control over marriage, divorce, conversions, etc., to the Orthodox. That was the division, the status quo, the modus vivendi that the two separate parts of Jews came to. This is, you could see this as an extension of what I just talked about, their reaction to Haskalah, the and the division into Reform and Conservative on one side versus and even you know, atheist Jews, and the Haredi or Haredim on the other side, the Orthodox Jews. I want to talk a little bit here about God and, you know, the Christian concept of God. And we write G-O-D and this tendency for Jews to write G-D. And that is that comes, again, from the Haredim. The custom of substituting the word God with G-D in English is based on the traditional practice of Jewish law, in Jewish law, of giving God's Hebrew name a high degree of respect and reverence. In fact, they euphemize, they have and have several names for God that arises just from that sort of irrational need to avoid using the name of God, starting with YHWH, Yahweh, which they never say. And then there's Adonai, which means master or lord, and they use that only for prayer. And then there's Hashem, which means literally the name, which they use at other times a little bit more loosely than Adonai. And then the Kabbalists actually have their own word for God, which is very important and crucial to their beliefs, Ein Sof, which means void or infinite or endless. And that actually resonates a bit with me. That's how I understand God for me. God is everything beyond human understanding. It's the infinite. I think it's interesting, though, that they pay such pedantic attention, the Jews do, to what seems like such a minor detail about taking God, and they're offended by seeing G-O-D, and so they've got to put a little dash through the O. But that is an aspect of Jewish personality. A Jewish personality trait is that sort of anal retentive attention to detail. One last aspect and one last group of Jews, and it's a big group that I'd like to discuss, is atheist Jews. And what really drives home the understanding of Judaism and Jewishness as not being based on religion, at least religion as Christians or Muslims or other things called religions think of religion as. There's an article from the Huffington Post from 2011 titled "Atheist Jews, Judaism Without God." And I don't want to read a lot from this. I'll quote large sections of it in my program post, but I'll just point out a few things here. Judaism is not dogmatic, according to this article, no creed to adhere to, and therefore atheists can be open about their lack of belief and still belong to a synagogue. That sounds like a contradiction. It sounds surprising to non-Jews, but apparently Jews find this perfectly acceptable. Well, why? Well, they go because they want some kind of ethnic identity, one of the experts that they quote says. They don't care about the prayers. It allows them to feel a sense of Jewishness, but it has little to do with religion. Exactly. It has to do with the people. Another quote, I want my kids to understand they are Jewish, to be proud of being Jewish, and to understand their heritage. Some woman said the article was really an elaboration and based on another article that they linked to in Moment magazine titled "Can There Be Judaism Without Belief in God?" And Moment magazine is a specifically Jewish magazine aimed at Jews talking to Jews about Jewish interests. So it's a little bit more honest about what's going on. And even though, you know, a lot of the discussion is couched in coded language, it can be decoded more easily. And here we find many sections acknowledging that it's not really God that's important about Jewishness. It's the people. As an atheist who identifies with my Jewishness, many of us make a distinction between Judaism as a religion and Judaism as a cultural and ethical outlook, and so on. There's many here. The most surprising thing that I discovered in that article in Moment magazine was that Robert Putnam, the famous author of Bowling Alone, is actually a convert to Judaism. And he actually says that I'm a Jew by choice. And it's because being Jewish is mostly not about beliefs, but about connections with other people, sharing values, and a collective destiny. Yes, indeed. Again, in conclusion here to both parts, which religion are we talking about when we talk about the Jewish religion? It's a form of conspiracy, really. It's an open conspiracy, coordination, cohesiveness, group strategizing by Jews. It's Jewish religion is a veil that Jews wear that obscures who they are and, you know, wraps them in mystery and secrecy. They're a people, not a religion.